initiating transmission.
Turn on that radio.
Talk about it.
That AM radio is a viable and modern source for news and entertainment.
So I guess we should probably go ahead and have a little talk.
Broadcasting live from the News Talk 1230 WFVA studios, overlooking the banks of the Rappahannock, it's WFVA Town Hall.
Good morning and welcome to a snowy Monday morning, not too snowy, fortunately. And the opportunity here is to have just enough white to make it look like Christmas, but not to get in your way. I'd like to invite you to come join me, not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, to join me at breakfast at the gorgeous Courtyard by Marriott in downtown Fredericksburg. Town Hall, in fact, is going on the road to the Marriott. And as my way of saying thanks for listening, we're going to be giving away some free Breakfast with Bob tickets for Tuesday's show on December 21st. I really would like to meet you, so as part of my expectation, I'd like to have you come up and actually introduce yourself, say hi, tell me who you are, where you're from, what you listen to, and you know, what you like or don't like. I'm very interested in meeting you. For that matter, I'd like to meet everyone who comes out to the Marriott next week. So don't hesitate to give us a call this morning at 820 and 835. We'll be giving away a free pair of tickets, and all you have to do is call 371-5756 and be the lucky seventh caller. That will be at 820 this morning. And again at 8:35, our way of saying thanks to you for listening to Town Hall with Bob Hagen. Join me December 21st at the Marriott in downtown Fredericksburg. Before dying last week, one of the most important things for Elizabeth Edwards was to prepare her children for her death. 10-year-old Jack, 12-year-old Emma Claire, and 28-year-old Kate. How do families cope with death? Are the holidays a reminder of loss for you? How do you get through them? Author and local bereavement coordinator Rob Zucker joins us Tuesday on WFVA Town Hall, 371-5756. Today, we're going to be talking about leadership, real leadership, not the kind that's simply appointed, not the kind that where you're necessarily talking about someone who's elected. We're looking at leadership both in management and, for that matter, in ethics. It's something that I think a lot of us feel is in short supply at all levels of government, as well as in sports, business, and, well, frankly, probably most organizations. So I'm going to ask you today to call and tell us who you think. Who do you think about? Who comes to mind when you think about real leadership? Who is it who has in some way or other motivated you to either do something in your life or to change your life? Because I think that's the sign of a real leader. You can give us a call at 371-5756. That's 371-5756. And to help us have that conversation this morning, Jim Melnick joins us today to discuss one of our earliest leaders and the contemporary impact of the lessons we find in his book, America's Oldest Corporation, and the first CEO, Harvard, and Henry Dunster. Jim is a former Pentagon intelligence analyst during the Cold War, a retired U.S. Army colonel, a graduate of Harvard University's Regional Studies Program in Russian Studies, and the president of a nonprofit evangelical organization. Jim Melnick, welcome to WFVA Town Hall.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here.
Jim, in order to help set the stage for our conversation this morning, would you tell us a little bit about the very start of Harvard University and how the first master ran it?
Well, it began really with the desire of some of the Puritan fathers who came to Massachusetts Bay Colony to begin a school. The desire was that Harvard would, what later became Harvard, would be a place to train clergy, to fill the churches, to fill the pulpits, and to be very dedicated to a high standard of learning. But things didn't get off to a very good start. There was not a lot of good oversight, even though the first governing body at Harvard was called the Board of Overseers, which the word overseer really was drawn from the scriptures, from 1 Timothy, the epistle, 1 Timothy in the New Testament, in which an overseer is supposed to give an account and to really to look over the flock of a church. And in this case, a group of men came together in the general court, Massachusetts Bay, and desired to found a college. That was the act of establishing a college in 1636. So Harvard really dates its beginning to 1636.
Which I think is really fascinating when you think about it, that given all the hardships that they had, that they did think about the need to have some higher education.
It was incredible. They're on the edge of the wilderness, in a sense trying just to stay alive, to survive, to continue to establish themselves. And yet these men and women were so dedicated to establishing a colony to God's glory. Really, that's what the Commonwealth meant, the biblical Commonwealth in Massachusetts. Now, they made a lot of mistakes along the way, but they did a lot of amazing things as well, some incredible things which have been unfortunately forgotten by this generation, I think, in many ways, because we don't know enough about them. There's a lot of revisionist history that I think needs to be looked at again.
And if I understand correctly, the first master of the school was known to beat the students from time to time, or to have them beaten.
Right. It was a guy named Nathaniel Eaton, and he was a real scoundrel. I mean, this guy was I don't know where you would begin to say, but in a sense, he came in probably, he may have come over on the ship with John Harvard himself, and John Harvard's own story is an amazing one. But so there was some connection there, we think, between the Eatons and the Harvards. And in any event, Eaton was put in charge, and they had a small group of students. They were just trying to get the thing going. So there wasn't much to Harvard at all. It hadn't even been named yet, really. And what happened was Thomas Shepard was the pastor of the local main church in Cambridge, outside of Boston. And he was one of the overseers, and he was upset. He said, "I'll mourn to the rest of my life that I didn't watch this carefully," because Eaton was beating the students. He was treating them terribly. His wife was shortchanging them on their daily food. In fact, there's a disgusting but famous episode where when this finally all came out in court, because it led to some charges, and one guy was beaten to the inch of his life, perhaps, and so everything came out in court eventually. And Eaton's wife, confessed on the stand, and she said, "Yes, I've been shortchanging on the rations, and I even put goat dung in the hasty pudding." And so this was a huge scandal. Actually, there's a famous club at Harvard called Hasty Pudding.
Hasty Pudding, absolutely.
Hasty Pudding Club. A number of U.S. presidents were members of it, in centuries later. But so Eaton left in disgrace. He actually came to Virginia. I'm not sure how long he was here, but he ended up going back to England. He became really a persecutor of Christians. And
he had that persecution thing down pretty well. He went to his strength when he went home, right?
And he ran off with the funds. I think he ran off with probably the bulk of much of what John Harvard left. And he died in a debtor's prison back in England.
So it does sound as though there are sometimes, in too many ways, some similarities between the past and the present, for sure. And I appreciate your bringing this up. Which that brings us, in fact, to Henry Dunster and a change that will forever impact our civilization. And if you would start
Absolutely.
By telling us, who was Henry Dunster and why he is important to us today?
Henry Dunster was the first president of Harvard, and in many ways, he shaped many of our institutions. He shaped really a lot of early American, and part of what I'm doing in my first book here on the Harvard as a corporation, and then a biography that I'm working on, other things as well, is to remember that legacy, because it's been forgotten or it's been put aside. And he was there in the beginning, really. He laid the foundation for our higher educational structure in America. He's the one that established the 4-year curriculum for colleges. If anyone ever wonders where that came from, why do you go for 4 years and for a regular liberal arts degree? That's because of Henry Dunster. He established that. But more than that, he set a very high standard of excellence. He had tremendous courage. He granted the first degrees in America when there was no authorization from anyone to do so. Back in England, the crown had the only authorization to grant a degree. It was something that conferred. It changed a person's class. You became a gentleman. You became, you had all kinds of authority and that were conferred at the
rights
act
and authority.
Rights and authority by obtaining a degree. So the very idea that somebody could, on their own authority, or in the case of Massachusetts, through the authority of the general court, grant a degree was really extraordinary. And I think it really was sort of the budding American spirit, that Henry Dunster exemplified. But his commitment to excellence is what really started Harvard on the right road and made it the institution that it is today in many ways.
Well, I really appreciate the information about the rights and authority, because I don't believe there's anyone in the last century, at least, who hasn't had a degree conferred and said to themselves, so I wonder what these rights and authorities are that I've got now that I didn't have before. So in what manner did Henry Dunster actually save Harvard? Did he come in? Was Eaton already gone when he showed up?
Eaton was gone, and the board of overseers, this group of Thomas Shepard and a few other men, they were desperate. Here they had gone and invested in trying to get something going. Parents had sent their young men, and they get this scandalous report of being whipped, and some of the students were whipped apparently 20 or 30 times. Lashes, 20 or 30 lashes. You can imagine the brutality of that. Really, Harvard was on the edge of a precipice, and Samuel Eliot Morison, who's really the greatest historian of Harvard history, has said, but for Henry Dunster, Harvard would have been into oblivion. It stood on the edge of a precipice. So he came in, and he arrived in Boston with his brother in 1640, in the summer of 1640, and he was a young minister who was a Puritan who had left England, and as the Puritans did, to find religious freedom here in America. And he was a graduate of Cambridge University, Magdalen College, which actually is the same college that C.S. Lewis was at before he died. So I've been there, and it's just wonderful to see that connection. But he came, and the Board of Overseers approached him almost immediately. As I said, they were desperate and said, would you consider...
So they were known to... he was known to them when he showed up.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Last year was the 400th anniversary of Dunster's birth, and I started an organization called the Henry Dunster Association. I'll tell more about that later, but it's at henrydunster.org. But basically, there's some question... We've sort of debated among ourselves whether they actually were anticipating, or there's a sort of a headhunter kind of thing, and he knew about it, or whether, this was a complete surprise when he arrived on the shore. So we don't have a firm, absolute, historical basis for knowing either way. But I lean to the direction that he did not know.
That he didn't have an understanding, that when he showed up, that it was essentially a surprise to him that there was a job all but waiting for him.
Right, right. I think that he was a minister, and he would have wanted to serve, in a pastoral capacity here, and he probably wanted to teach because he had taught at a grammar school back in England, but whether he had any notion that he would be taking over this small little group of students.
So there's no evidence that they sent for him, for instance?
No. There were some connections between people who knew him back in his church, but that's all we know.
So here we have Henry Dunster, who is arriving in the New World, and he's going to take over what ultimately would become Harvard University. He is assigning himself, or being assigned, the term president, and perhaps the first president, and certainly the first CEO in the New World. And we're going to learn more about how he managed to save an institution that was on the precipice. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Right now, I'd like to remind you that not tomorrow, but a week from Tuesday, on December 21st, Town Hall is going on the road, and we're going to the Marriott in downtown Fredericksburg. We're also going to be having breakfast, and you're invited to join me, and I'm going to be giving away tickets to that breakfast. Be very happy to have you join me, and in order to get tickets and free tickets for breakfast and join me a week from Tuesday at the Marriott, all you have to do is give us a call, 371-5756. Again, that's 371-5756. The lines are cleared, and you can call now, 371-5756.
BBQ Post 401.
Friends, that's us chopping barbecue at BBQ Post 401 on Route 3 East. This is Nelson Head behind the Pink Pig microphone, and for us Southerners, it's all about meat. Fast food boys have trouble peddling fat-filled, pitiful thin patties when there's great queue nearby. In Woodbridge, that's the case at my Dixie Bonds, where we've been serving hickory smoked barbecue since 1996. I opened BBQ Post 401 because my Fredericksburg friends wanted good queue on Route 3 instead of up north off 95. Check out bbqpost401.com. Or better still, come try my barbecue. You'll see our pit smell smoke and hear us chopping it for you. As a meat guy raised in Alabama, I like good barbecue a whole lot better than fat-filled, pitiful thin patties, and you will too. This is Nelson Head signing off from the Pink Pig microphone at BBQ Post 401 in front of Staples on Route 3 East.
Happy holidays! Glenda the Giftologist here. Say, do you sometimes worry if you're giving someone a good enough gift? Like, well, Aunt Lily loved that power drill. Will your brother dig that DVD? When in doubt, why not throw in some holiday scratchers from the Virginia Lottery? Games like Cash Flurry, Movie Night, and one called Holiday Cash could turn into something even bigger. So give and relax. Glenda says, holiday scratchers from the Virginia Lottery.
Your closet is full of movie reels and videos that you can't watch. I have your answer. Adam's here from Transvideo. Now, you have a unique holiday gift idea for our listeners, transferring old home movies and videos onto DVD to share again with family and friends.
The best thing is we're running a holiday special to transfer your 16mm regular Super 8 films and videotapes onto DVD.
So how do you do this?
First, we clean, lubricate, repair, and restore your films. Then, we digitally transfer the film, adjusting the light and color levels constantly. Plus, we edit out the bad spots. Give me a call. 1-800-209-4501.
You know, it occurs to me, you could also transfer videotapes like VHS and Beta, 8mm and DV.
Give me a call, 1-800-209-4501, and we'll digitally transfer your movies for you.
You need to write this down, 1-800-209-4501. Transferring your home movies makes a wonderful gift for everyone to share.
Here's Time Saver Traffic on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
On the ride northbound along I-95, no late-breaking issues at the moment. The road surface seems to be drying out, so that's helping out a lot. Temperature staying above the freezing mark. Check Rooney, and the salt and sand crews have been out since early this morning, just in case there were any icy patches. Had a couple of accidents earlier. Looks like they're still tending to one over on the right shoulder northbound on 95 north of the Occoquan River, but only have delays beginning before 123 up to that point. Then you're okay to Springfield. 395 will slow, looks like, a little after the Beltway now, and that's going to continue most of the way up into Shirlington. You'll slow down again as you head north of the Pentagon to the 14th Street Bridge. Lanes open. Inner loop of the Beltway bunches up before Braddock Road. That's going to go up to I-66. Your outer loop delays are from Van Dorn Street now headed over through Alexandria. Traffic is brought to you by Xfinity. Weather calls for movie night at home, and with Xfinity TV, you have the access to the world's greatest collection of shows and movies instantly on your TV and online. Call 800-XFINITY. I'm Robert Workman, Time Saver Traffic.
We have a winter weather advisory in effect until 9 a.m. for snow. We're not looking at a whole lot of snow here, perhaps around an inch, but this could definitely make for some slippery spots this morning. We've also got some gusts up around 25 or 30 miles an hour, and that could lead to a little blowing snow and perhaps some small areas of reduced visibility. So look for overcast skies with windy conditions today, some light snow out there in spots. Highs will be in the mid-30s today. Flurries this evening, lows down around 20. Partly cloudy, windy, staying cold, highs around the freezing mark tomorrow, sunny mid-30s Wednesday. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Natoso from the Weather Channel on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Good morning and welcome back to WFVA Town Hall. It is a Monday morning with just a dusting of snow, nothing too terrible. And we're glad to have you join us this morning. And this morning we are talking about leadership. And I would ask you if you've had someone in your life that you would identify as a leader, someone who has motivated you to do something, perhaps make a change in your life, not just an elected official, not just someone who's been appointed to a position of leadership, but someone who has exhibited leadership in a way that motivated you to take action. And we're talking this morning with Jim Melnick, who's telling us about an individual like that, an individual who led others to real action, and that person was Henry Dunster. Henry Dunster, who was the first president of Harvard, and as we now know, not the first master, not the first person who ran it. Jim, could you tell us about that term title? The first person who ran Harvard was called the master of the school, and yet suddenly we have someone who's identified as the president.
Right. It's something that Dunster himself chose, and it's quite interesting. to begin with, let me backtrack a second, because I've sometimes referred to him as the first president of the New World, and what happens when you write a book is you sometimes find out that you're wrong. You know, as you do more research, more things come out, and there is this, of course, constant friendly competition through the centuries between Massachusetts and Virginia over who was first in this and in that, you know, aspect of history. And even though I think my definition of Dunster as being the first president of the New World is accurate in terms of being a homegrown, there is actually a Virginia role in this as well, because Captain John Smith in Jamestown was actually elected as the president of this, of the small group that helped, you know, keep Jamestown going in the early days. So we have that competition as well, but between Virginia and Massachusetts. But from the standpoint, but
certainly, it's an unusual term at that time.
Yes, yes, exactly. And what when Eton was designated master, that was very close to what was expected in English universities at the time and colleges, that the person who ran it was the master. And you still see this term used today, even in England, in many places. But the idea of president was a subsidiary role, actually. It comes from the Latin praeses. And there is actually a chair for the praeses, you know, the president at Magdalen College, where Dunster's from. So it's thought that he brought that concept with him. But the idea was when Dunster gave to himself this title of president, and that was later affirmed, it was more a role of humble leadership. He was basically saying, yes, I will preside, I will take care of things. But he was not saying for sure that he would have to be the top guy forever.
That's very interesting. There's a phrase that we often use these days in terms of being a servant leader.
Yes, he was very much a servant leader. And the overseers soon discovered they'd found the right man. That here was a man who devoted his life to the institution, to his faith, to promoting everything that he could about the gospel, and to maintain this very high standard of excellence in learning. And so he imbued really in the institution. The institution was imbued rather with this sense of excellence and the sacrificial leadership that he showed. So He basically charted the institution through that very rough period. We saw now he arrived in 1640. That was still a sort of, if we think about the the market bubble and the real estate bubble of the last year or so, in a sense it was a little similar to that. That everything was going very well. Thousands and thousands of people were coming over to Massachusetts during the immigration, the Puritan immigration, and they brought with them, you know, whatever they could.
Times were good.
And then right about that end of that summer, beginning of the fall in 1641, suddenly the bottom fell out. Things became very difficult. It is actually referred to as the Depression of 1641. And so Dunster comes in. He's got this ragtag sort of group of students, the parents that were willing to let their sons remain after the likes of Eton. He has a dispirited group of people that, you know, just desperate to have him sort of try to hold things together. And he builds and he works and he devotes himself. He was a young man of 30, I mean, a bachelor of 30. He ended up marrying a widow who had five children. So he takes over Harvard. He's now raising five children. He was only married to her for a couple of years when she died. The first printing press in the New World is in his house. So, wow. So they're running off, you know, some of the most. I mean, if you're a book collector, some of those sought after and most rare books or and manuscripts, you know, were things that were lying around Dunster's house, you know, and as he was trying to manage that as well. And, I mean, it's just incredible all the things that he was doing, and at the same time was able to do it successfully and with excellence.
And also balancing life with work, something that's a very contemporary kind of issue for everyone. You were talking about him being a servant leader, and that's a term that we often apply to people who are involved in nonprofits and religious areas, but it's not often a term that we hear applied to a CEO.
Right.
And yet the title of the book, America's Oldest Corporation and the First CEO, Harvard and Henry Dunster, clearly identifies him as the CEO of the first corporation.
Exactly. And what I wanted to do with this book, because I'm working on a larger biography, which is, I told you earlier, it's sort of like if someone's familiar with Lord of the Rings by Tolkien, which I love. But, you know, to get the whole story of Lord of the Rings, you know, you start with The Hobbit, you know, and it gets you into the story. In my case, I've been working this very long biography, but I realized this whole aspect of servant leadership was something that really needed to be heard in the business world and by leaders, by CEOs today. And so I spun off this book to really as my little Hobbit book, basically, to start the process of trying to reintroduce Henry Dunster to the modern day. And so what I go into are all the aspects of his servant leadership and how he gave of his own time, money, talent, treasure to keep Harvard together. He also was one of the first or primary backers of one of the first grammar schools in America. In fact, that wasn't even the money that was owed to him. Him was never even paid until after his estate was settled, you know, many, many years later.
So one of the things that we're seeing then is that one of the ways that he was able to work through these tough economic times was that he was giving of his own resources.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, he did that throughout his life. But what happened in 1650, which is interesting and timely from the standpoint of just this past week, is he put together the first corporation charter in America, the Harvard Charter of 1650. And that charter actually set up an interesting dynamic because he already had the Board of Overseers where they were sort of obviously in existence before he got there. But he realized that wasn't sufficient, you know, just to having one Board of Trustees that came in once in a while was not sufficient. He wanted a governing body that would have some checks and balances. So he set up the Harvard Corporation. And I think that was also sort of a prototype in the early days of this concept of checks and balances between two governing bodies. So you see, even in the very early days of Harvard, sort of a very faint prototype of what would eventually emerge more than a century, you know, and a quarter later in the United States Constitution. Actually, even the title of president, going back to that for a second, there was no president of the United States because there was no United States. And for generations, even before the United States existed, when someone said the president, they always meant the president of Harvard. And so even when George Washington, you know, came to Cambridge and he assumed command of the Continental Army, actually not far from where I was when I was a student at Harvard. And so that was always inspiring to me. But you know, that whole essence of what a president is and that leadership was something that was already well established. And so it would have sort of been out there and for the founding fathers to sort of draw from that as part of many things, but, you know, they
Jim,
could draw from
let's
that.
Let's talk about for a moment sort of the essence of the man. Here is an institution that was on the verge of collapse. He takes over. Times are good for 15 minutes, and then suddenly they go very bad. He's suddenly giving up of himself. He has a concept of being that servant leader we've been talking about. And yet when he sets up the corporation, he sets it up with checks and balances. So he's limiting his own ability to make decisions by himself. Do you think that's evidence of that leadership?
Absolutely. And I that goes to his Puritan background and understanding of that men are sinful and need to have some checks and balances, that no one should have all the power in a unitary system. And that was something that he realized right away. But what I wanted to say in terms of what was recent is that this essential structure, there were some upheavals in the late 17th century and early 18th century, but other than that, which was then rectified by a major political compromise, other than those minor upheavals, Dunster's charter has remained in force as written to this day. It is the governing document that he wrote in 1650 that has not changed through 2010. And just last week, Harvard University announced their desire to change that structure of the corporation. So it was originally 7 members. They wanted it to be 13 members. But the structure that he put in place and the checks and balance system has survived 360 years.
Are there other changes occurring besides the number of overseers?
Well, it's mostly to the corporate. They're making some changes in the overseers, but it's to the number of in the corporation. It looks as if, yes, they're going to try to put some term limits in. And it's an interesting dynamic what they want to do. I'm still looking at some of that and what are the ramifications of it. But in fact, I have some questions on the legality of it, because there's a Harvard is so old. The corporation itself was established, again, as I said, before the United States existed. And And this was brought up even by Daniel Boorstin, who was a former librarian of Congress, very famous historian. He said, well, Harvard's authority, legitimacy to even grant degrees is in question. And I debunked that in my book because I show where he was completely wrong. Here's Daniel Boorstin. But the reason he's wrong is because the Harvard's current legitimacy and legal status is established in the Massachusetts Constitution. That was done by John Adams himself, who was an alumnus, obviously our second president. And he looked out for Harvard very, very well. He made sure that all the right legalese was in the Massachusetts Constitution. So if anyone wants to look that up, that's, I think, Chapter 5 or Section 5 of the Massachusetts Constitution, which to this day is the legal basis, really, for enshrining Harvard's corporate status. And so, you know, Harvard can go ahead and make this change, I think, if they desire, but it could be subject to some other provisions of the Constitution or perhaps even the legislature.
You're listening to Jim Melnick, the author of America's Oldest Corporation and First CEO, Harvard and Henry Dunster's. We talk about leadership here this morning on Town Hall. I want to remind you that a week from Tuesday, December 21st, I would like to invite you and a friend to join me for breakfast at the Courtyard by Marriott in downtown Fredericksburg. Town Hall is going on the road to the Marriott, and as my way of saying thanks for listening, we'll be giving away free Breakfast with Bob tickets for that Tuesday show right now. And that's going to be December 21st, and you're invited to come to the Marriott, join us for a live show and for breakfast. All you have to do is call 371-5756 and be the third caller. The lines are clear, and if you'd like to join me for breakfast on Tuesday the 21st, give us a call at 371-5756.
You feel secure, safe, and comfortable. So when you think about the people you love who are in need of extra care and attention, remember, their home feels the same to them. And that's why Home Instead Senior Care is there. A little help is all it takes. It's an extra hand for reaching items stacked a little too high. It's getting them to appointments and picking up medications, keeping things organized. It's helping tie bows on packages during the holidays, getting an extra blanket to make sure they're more comfortable. Home Instead Senior Care is exactly what it says. It's personal care for your loved one in their own home instead of a facility. Call now to learn more, 540-899-1422. That's 540-899-1422. Online at homeinstead.com/Fredericksburg VA. Home Instead Senior Care, helping you care for the seniors in your life. To them, it's personal.
Here's Time Saver Traffic on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
On the ride northbound along I-95, no late-breaking issues at the moment. The road surface seems to be drying out, so that's helping out a lot. Temperature staying above the freezing mark. Check Rooney, and the salt and sand crews have been out since early this morning, just in case there were any icy patches. Had a couple of accidents earlier. Looks like they're still tending to one over on the right shoulder northbound on 95 north of the Occoquan River, but only have delays beginning before 123 up to that point. Then you're okay to Springfield. 395 will slow, looks like, a little after the Beltway now, and that's going to continue most of the way up into Shirlington. You'll slow down again as you head north of the Pentagon to the 14th Street Bridge. Lanes open. Inner loop of the Beltway bunches up before Braddock Road. That's going to go up to I-66. Your outer loop delays are from Van Dorn Street now headed over through Alexandria. Traffic is brought to you by Xfinity. Weather calls for movie night at home, and with Xfinity TV, you have the access to the world's greatest collection of shows and movies instantly on your TV and online. Call 800-XFINITY. I'm Robert Workman, Time Saver Traffic.
We have a winter weather advisory in effect until 9 a.m. for snow. We're not looking at a whole lot of snow here, perhaps around an inch, but this could definitely make for some slippery spots this morning. We've also got some gusts up around 25 or 30 miles an hour, and that could lead to a little blowing snow and perhaps some small areas of reduced visibility. So look for overcast skies with windy conditions today, some light snow out there in spots. Highs will be in the mid-30s today. Flurries this evening, lows down around 20. Partly cloudy, windy, staying cold. Highs around the freezing mark tomorrow. Sunny mid-30s Wednesday. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Natoso from the Weather Channel on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Good morning and welcome to WFEA Town Hall again. Appreciate having you join us this morning. Appreciate having you back with us. We are this morning talking about leadership. and would be very interested in hearing you talk about any examples of leadership you would like to bring up. We're talking with Jim Melnick today to discuss one of the earliest leaders and also the contemporary impact of the lessons that we find in his book, America's Oldest Corporation and the First CEO, Harvard and Henry Dunster. Well, it's certainly interesting because Eaton is the first master. He has students who have been beaten, students who have been starved. Dunster takes over. He's in tough economic times. Certainly we recognize tough economic times. Tell me, what was it that motivated you to become interested in Dunster? Was there something in your life, some turning point, something happened that made you say, this guy is worthy of the time and effort to tell other people?
It really started with my time as a graduate student at Harvard when I was there in the mid-70s. And, there are interesting things in life. You know, one particular incident might obviously change a number of things as you go through it. And for me, it was seeing a sign. It was seeing on a church. It was the Unitarian Church in near Harvard Square.
So you did literally get a sign.
I saw the sign.
The sign.
The sign upset me because it was implying that this Unitarian Church had been Unitarian from the beginning, from the 1630s. And I thought, well, that's not right. That's wrong. And there's something wrong here. And that began sort of this quest to look into the history of what is this all about. That led eventually to me reading a lot about early Harvard history and what happened. And the Puritans really ran Harvard until about 1805 when the Unitarians took over in an upset. But in a sense, that began my interest in reading and finding. I wonder, who were these men? Who were these men and women that began this amazing institution and really breathed life into it and gave it such a Harvard is rated by many to be the greatest or one of the greatest universities in the world. And how did this end up starting in America on the edge of the wilderness? That really intrigued me. And so anyway, there's next to the church at Harvard Square, which was Henry Dunster's church and Thomas Shepard's church, is a graveyard. And as I was reading about this, I thought, well, I want to find Dunster's grave. And I finally did. And it wasn't very well marked. The marker on it had all sort of been almost faded away. It had been more than a century than anybody had done anything, and that began a campaign really on my part to get Harvard to do something about that. You need to mark the grave of your first president. That was
and the man who had brought it back from the brink.
That's right. So I took it on as a personal quest, and got Neil Rudenstein, who was the president of Harvard at the time, engaged him basically. Via the mail, and he responded positively and said, we'll look into this. And one thing led to another, and that eventually led to Harvard marking the grave, which I was very happy about. What we realized during that whole process was how much more needed to be done in terms of letting people know about this man, his legacy.
Well, in regards to that specifically, and let me be the first person to use the term groupies as it relates to Henry Dunster. The groupies of Henry Dunster can get more information by looking at a website. Isn't that right? You're head of an organization.
Right. Well, we're a pretty small group of groupies. Okay. But I started the Henry Dunster Association recently, a couple years ago, and it's at henrydunster.org or henrydunster.com. I have both domains. They both resolve to the same site. And that site is the one of our association, which is a small group of people that are interested in his life and legacy. It includes myself, obviously, a gentleman who lives in Bury, Lancashire in England, which is where Dunster was born. And then we have three or four others who are quite interested. Some of them are descendants and just people who are very interested in his life and legacy. But the book, can be, if people are interested, can be found there and ordered through Amazon, or there's another company is Buy Books on the Web is one I work with. But as I said, it's part of this larger project and effort. And what I'm doing on the website is to try to piece together and to put a lot of links and a lot of information content for people who'd like to read about them. One of the things that Harvard did as we pursued all this was to eventually digitize the Henry Dunster papers at Harvard and put them online. So anyone can click on there and look at just some of these interesting documents that are right available now online that was never the case before. And then the other earlier biography that was done in 1872 and then a genealogy that was done in 1876. So mine will be the first modern biography since that time. But there are links to all of those you know, other aspects of his life that we don't have time to go into today, well, but just some amazing things.
Let's talk about a contemporary president, Larry Summers, who resigned as Harvard's president before going to President Obama's administration as one of his chief economic advisors. Would you talk a little bit about Henry Dunster and the difficult economic times that he had in the Depression of 1641 versus Larry Summers and how the two perhaps managed the university?
Well, there is quite there's quite a comparison. There was a Boston newspaper that tried to compare the two because Dunster eventually resigned from Harvard, and what they were trying to do was compare his experience to Summers in this newspaper article, but it really wasn't much of a comparison. I mean, the two men are very, very different. Dunster obviously was a servant leader who sacrificed a great deal and really gave everything of himself to make Harvard a success. Summers is a different kind of person. I don't want to compare them on that level, but and he obviously, you know, the university in the 21st century is a much different institution than what Harvard was in the 17th century, and yet there are certain principles that you know don't change. They are timeless. They are changeless, and I think some of the things of concern is that we saw. I mean, Summers is a brilliant man, and he obviously has a very extensive background, but you know, some of the things that were put in place at Harvard at the time. This is before he came into the Obama administration, had an endowment in about mid-2008 of $36.9 billion. It was the largest, I think, anywhere as far as universities, certainly in the United States. And I actually wrote an article which never got published because I'm sure no one wanted to read this, but I said, how many Harvard geniuses does it take to lose $8 billion, which is what happened. So Summers, you know, again, it wasn't all his fault. There were many people involved. There's a group called the Harvard Management Company, which is in charge of Harvard's investments, and just, I mean, scores and scores of fund managers. And I mean, you can't imagine, just, you know, hundreds of people and billions of dollars on the line. But, you know, when it's all said and done, it comes down to, you know, just basic principles of, you know, what makes sense? How do you conserve, you know, do you conserve your capital when you think you might be going through a difficult time? Do you carefully allocate? And so now Harvard, like many universities and across the country and other organizations, is really scrambling. They've had to, part of this corporation change is due to that financial crisis, because they're really having to tighten their belts. And so Summers leaves Harvard and he comes and basically runs the U.S. economy. So we see, again, it's not all his fault where we're at, but you have to wonder, you know, some of these guys are brilliant and yet almost, you know, too smart for themselves in the sense of trying to be, perhaps not getting back to basics. So, and we're being forced to get back to basics because the economy now is forcing us to do that.
At the very least, we might observe that in difficult times under Larry Summers, things didn't get better at Harvard, and that under difficult times in the United States, things are not apparently getting any better either. Real simply, listen to me, because we have just a moment before our next break. How do you think Dunster would view Harvard today?
I think he would be, and I have a chapter on my book concerning that. I think he would be very happy with respect to the commitment to excellence, but he would be very saddened by sort of the secularism, by the lack of really the foundational principle for him was his faith in Jesus Christ. He laid that down. He laid that down as the law, as a college law. He said that students, their main end of their life and studies would be to know God and Jesus Christ and to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. And so that's really what Veritas, which is the famous Harvard motto, means. It means a search for truth. But he meant it in the search of biblical truth, but in the larger sense as well. I mean, he obviously would be pleased, I think, for the search for knowledge.
All so a singular are. Truth in terms of a supreme being.
Yes. That education and our institutions and really the essence of who we are and what our nation is and education itself is derived from that foundation. And without that, then we're just adrift.
You're listening to Jim Melnick as we talk today about leaders, and we talk in particular about the first CEO of Harvard, Henry Dunster. Now and get it for less
at J&J Tile and Marble. The holidays are coming, so it's time to think about giving yourself the holiday gift you've been longing for. Now you can, because J&J Tile and Marble is featuring up to 70% off all in-stock items. Choose from the finest selection of Italian tile, porcelain, ceramic, and mosaics, with the largest selection of glass mosaics. Offering 0% financing for qualified buyers could be just the gift you need to get started. Just ask your J&J specialist for details. Get inspired while you're visiting their showroom. With 20 bath and shower displays, if you get started today, you could have it all done in time for the holidays. J&J Tile has the wow factor you need to jazz up any project. Their in-house design team is proud to deliver the best service and the best prices, guaranteed. J&J Tile and Marble, 4763 Jefferson Davis Highway in Fredericksburg. Online at jjtileandmarble.com. J&J Tile and Marble, no gimmicks, just great deals every day.
I like to bake and cook, and we go out for drives in my husband's sports car, and we love to travel.
Susan Brooks, breast cancer patient.
I was scheduled for a routine mammogram. I wasn't going to go. I was mad and I was angry, but everybody was so compassionate. I'm just glad, really, to be alive. I felt like I got great care.
Mary Washington Healthcare. Superior cancer care. Here. For you.
Let's go. How would you like to eat out for half the cost? With WFEA's 50-50 Fridays, you can do just that. This Friday, buy $50 gift certificates to Salsa Rita's Fresh Cantina for just $25. $50 gift certificates for just $25. Goes on sale Friday at 9 a.m. at newstalk1230.net. You definitely don't want to miss out. It's WFVA's 50-50 Fridays on Newstalk 1230 WFVA. Here's Time Saver Traffic on Newstalk 1230 WFVA.
On the ride northbound along I-95, no late breaking issues at the moment. The road surface seems to be drying out, so that's helping out a lot. Temperature staying above the freezing mark. Check Karuni, and the salt and sand crews have been out since early this morning just in case there were any icy patches. Had a couple of accidents earlier. Looks like they're still tending to one over on the right shoulder northbound on 95 north of the Occoquan River, but only have delays beginning before 123 up to that point. Then you're okay to Springfield. 395 will slow, looks like, a little after the Beltway now, and that's going to continue most of the way up into Shirlington. You'll slow down again as you head north of the Pentagon to the 14th Street Bridge. Lanes open. Inner loop of the Beltway bunches up before Braddock Road. That's going to go up to I-66. Your outer loop delays are from Van Dorn Street now headed over through Alexandria. Traffic is brought to you by Xfinity. Weather calls for movie night at home, and with Xfinity TV, you have the access to the world's greatest collection of shows and movies instantly on your TV and online. Call 800-XFINITY. I'm Robert Workman, Time Saver Traffic.
We have a winter weather advisory in effect until 9 a.m. for snow. We're not looking at a whole lot of snow here, perhaps around an inch, but this could definitely make for some slippery spots this morning. We've also got some gusts up around 25 or 30 miles an hour, and that could lead to a little blowing snow and perhaps some small areas of reduced visibility. So look for overcast skies with windy conditions today, some light snow out there in spots. Highs will be in the mid-30s today. Flurries this evening, lows down around 20. Partly cloudy, windy, staying cold, highs around the freezing mark tomorrow, sunny mid-30s Wednesday. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Natoso from the Weather Channel on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to WFVA Town Hall. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Bob Hagan, and today we're talking with Jim Melnick about leadership. And we're talking about leadership and one of our earliest leaders, someone who helped to save Harvard University, basically as a servant leader, turned it around. Jim, there's all kinds of stories and information that we haven't had time for and aren't going to be able to get to this morning. But would you take a moment to tell us about a connection between Harvard and Fredericksburg?
Yes, it's a story, Bob, of Phillips Brooks. And he's someone I write about a little bit in my book. And it actually with respect to donations at Harvard. And this man was so beloved at the time. He was a minister. He was in Boston. And then he was one of the overseers at Harvard. And just beloved by the students there, is one of the most famous figures in Harvard history. And this is long
and
after.
And what era are we talking about here?
19th century. So this is many years after Dunster. But again, this is related in my book in terms of Harvard's, how the corporation has done things through the centuries. So that's how I got into the Phillips Brooks situation. But so Phillips Brooks basically was ordained and was an Episcopal minister and had come down to Virginia from Boston. And what I didn't know about, I was on one of the trolley tours here in Fredericksburg by my good friend Kathy Kwan, who does a wonderful tour of our history here in the city. And we were going by in the trolley by St. George's Episcopal Church, and she told a story about the one of our most beloved Christmas hymns, O Little Town of Bethlehem. And that was written by Phillips Brooks. And she said, and the man who wrote that hymn preached his first sermon here in Fredericksburg. I almost fell out of my chair. I thought, well, I've just written about it. You know, I didn't know the connection at all. And so that was before the Civil War. And then, of course, during the Civil War, we know, you know, our city here was bombarded by Union forces. And it's just amazing to think that connection. I wonder what Phillips Brooks thought when when that was occurring. He was back in Boston by that time. And then he wrote A Little Town of Bethlehem, which, you know, as we're in the Christmas season, is just such a hymn of peace and joy. And that came out a few years after the Civil War. So, you know, I've often thought now, what were his thoughts about Fredericksburg during that time and all the things that he went through. And then when he, later in life, when he died, it was a time of, when Phillips Brooks died, it was a time of incredible mourning in Boston. There were eight, I think, Harvard students who carried his coffin, and it was almost a day of mourning in the city. He was that beloved. So there's that interesting connection between him and Fredericksburg.
There were no shortage of scoundrels also from Harvard, and I know there's at least one that we should talk about before we're done this morning.
Yeah, that was George Downing. He was referred to as graduate number two, Harvard graduate number two. So and when you had class ranks and all that sort of thing, it began in the very beginning. The first one was a man named graduate number one was Benjamin Woodridge, but Downing was number two. And this was a sad and interesting story. Downing obviously showed great promise at the time. He would have been taught by Dunster. He was in that first class of eight students. That was the class of 1642, which was the first graduating class in American history, college class. And so Dunster, again, he would have been one of the young students that he would have poured himself into and as he began his training. And many other famous ones would come later of wonderful graduates. But Downing was a great disappointment in the sense that in the beginning, he was considered to be a success story. He went back to England. Cromwell noticed his talents and he was appointed to positions under that, but later he turned out to be quite a scoundrel.
Well, okay, that's fascinating, Jim Melnick. I just appreciate very much your being here today to talk to us about one of the great leaders before our country was a country, and his relationship to Harvard University, how he helped to turn that university around and to make it the institution that we know it today, and to have be the first CEO, and to have a corporate charter that's lasted some 360 years before even minor changes are being made to it. And we could discuss whether those were minor or not at some later date. Thanks for joining us at Town Hall. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the holidays, but we're going to be talking about grief through the holidays and how people manage as families to get through the loss of a loved one. Tomorrow on Town Hall on WFVA.
A centennial broadcasting